From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Baby Hunters Point.
Hayward.
Piedmont, California.
Pleasanton.
Fall Town.
Richmond.
Sunset.
Oakland, California.
Concord, California.
Fairfield.
Foothill.
Coming up, an alternative to calling 911 in the Tenderloin.
Just by being able to respond to him when he's in that crisis. And when we do that, they come back and they realize, all right, I can stick with this one more day.
Then the unexpectedly progressive politics behind a sexy book cover.
It's definitely very much the Trojan horse cover. Like, you look at this woman, you don't think, now that screams feminist healthcare and wealth redistribution.
And the story behind this week's audiograph mystery sound.
The machine becomes so odious.
Hey, you want to take a flyer?
Makes you so sick at heart.
We're showing a demonstration of what it's like to go through an Israeli checkpoint.
All will be revealed. Today on Cross Currents. Stick around. The vast majority of San Francisco's homeless population lives in the Tenderloin. Many of them suffer from substance abuse issues and untreated mental health problems, and that can lead to mental health breakdowns on the street. But general crisis resources like 911 aren't always the best equipped to handle these crisis situations. That's when volunteers step in. KLW's Allison Levitsky has the story.
Jacob Savage almost became a cop. He spent high school and college going on police ride-alongs, wearing a uniform and a bulletproof vest.
And I really thought I was going to be a cop, but eventually you start to see the reality, the unfortunate reality of the system's criminalization of mental illness.
So now, instead of wearing a blue uniform and a badge, Jacob wears a purple t-shirt. On it is the name of the nonprofit he founded in 2014, Concern, which is an alternative to calling 911 for mental health crises in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. Today we're at the corner of Jones and Eddy Street. We're getting ready to do what Jacob calls street response, passing out harm reduction supplies, asking people if they need help accessing services, and most importantly, answering dispatch calls if they come in.
And we will send a team of compassionate trained responders to handle the crisis, to support somebody through a difficult circumstance.
Jacob is well known in the Tenderloin. He wears a walkie-talkie and greets some of the homeless people by name.
So, Mr. Ian, what can I do for you, sir?
He carries a trumpet, which he'll often just start playing in the street. It also helps to break the ice with people in crisis situations.
Try to guess what their age is and then think back to what was number one on the billboards when they were, 21 years old. That's sometimes a good technique.
There's a certain casualness surrounding Concern's approach to mental health crisis response. It's really about connecting with their clients as equals, not just giving them medical attention. And since Concern responders aren't police or city officials, they're just volunteers in purple shirts. People feel at ease around them. They trust them.
I think it's great. We can use all the help we can get in the city.
That's Jim Zelaya Wagner, the director of San Francisco's homeless outreach team. They do a lot of the same work as Concern, but they're a city agency.
There's no two ways about it. I mean, we've got 30 outreach workers, and we're looking at a city of homeless individuals of anywhere from 6 to 7,000. I mean, based on the last year's count, that's a lot of homeless folks. So, hey, the more people that can help, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
San Francisco has the second highest rate of homelessness in the country, and the majority of them suffer from mental illness. The city does offer a number of mental health care programs already, but it's not enough. Last week, the city's new Department of Homelessness announced a new plan. It's developing a system to track the services each homeless person has been connected to, including jail, rehab, and housing agencies. This is supposed to help figure out what's not working, but it won't go into effect for another 2 years. For now, though, the reality is in the streets, and that's where Jacob is. Back out on the street, close to UN Plaza, we find a group of crack and heroin users shooting up on the sidewalk behind the Asian Art Museum. Blood dripped down one man's forearm from where he'd just injected himself.
You guys want any clean Zabrillo? We got some harm reduction supplies.
Yeah.
Let's see what we got here. Let's open that backpack.
28s to 29s as well for me and Brillo.
28s and 29s are different sizes of needles for injecting drugs. Concern distributes clean syringes so that people don't share or reuse them, which can spread disease. Brillo, I learned, is used as a filter in a crack pipe.
First of all, if you don't have a filter and like you hit crack and then it like you swallow it, that could hurt and just do bad things.
One young man is standing apart from the others. He's leaning against a wall and Jacob doesn't recognize him. So Jacob goes up and introduces himself.
By the way, we're concerned. My name's Jacob. We do mental health crisis outreach. Is there anything we can help you with today? Any resources we connect you to? Hook you up with a 90-day shelter bed, or at least get you on the reservation system?
Yeah, I wanna go.
You do?
He reluctantly tells Jacob his name, birth date, and the last four of his social security number. I'm gonna refer to him as Terrence to protect his privacy.
I've been on the street for like a couple years.
He says he's been on the street for a few years. Terrence mumbles a lot, and his train of thought is hard to follow. He doesn't answer our questions directly, and it sometimes seems like he's talking to someone who isn't there. But he says he has family in Oakland and that he's 24.
Why don't I call 311, okay, and get you on the shelter reservation system?
We're out at UN Plaza. We're going to be trying to get somebody in the reservation system for shelter.
We walk him the 8 blocks to Glide Memorial Church, which operates a social services agency in the Tenderloin. The walk takes almost half an hour because Terrence keeps stopping to take hits of crack. We go inside the church and start the process of signing Terrence up for a shelter bed.
I'll see if I can start the process with him.
Jacob tries to coax Terrence into getting his picture taken and his fingerprint scanned so he can be entered into the system. But Terrence seems nervous, and after 15 minutes, he gets up and walks out. He says it's just taking too long, and that he's scared of getting robbed in a shelter. He was one fingerprint short of a full set, and Glide couldn't register him for a shelter bed without it. Jacob has seen this before.
It's difficult to get a lot of people's services, and we have to be okay with the fact that we don't have amazing access to what limited resources there are, but we do have ourselves in the moment to be supportive and just make somebody feel cared for.
Jacob and his team at Concern can't help everybody, but they keep working to reach as much of the Tenderloin's homeless population as they can. When Concern started, they had just 2 trained responders. Now that number's up to 18. And if they keep growing, Jacob dreams of expanding to other parts of the city. For Cross Currents, I'm Allison Levitsky.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. If you came of age in the 90s in the Bay, you might be familiar with Aya De Leon. She was a local slam poet hero who found fame touring the States with her hip-hop theater show, Thieves in the Temple. Now she's out with her first novel, Uptown Thief, which she calls a feminist heist novel. The book's heroine, Marisol Rivera, is kind of a sex-positive Robin Hood, running a resource center for low-income women bankrolled by a high-end escort service. Rivera swindles corrupt CEOs and funnels the money back to the women supported by her clinic. Aya De Leon came to our studios to speak with KALW's Jen Chien and to share an excerpt of the new book.
I wanted to start with a reading from your book, from the first chapter of your book. And this comes right after the opening scene, which has our main character, Marisol Rivera, running down a flight of stairs with $10,000 stolen dollars in her purse.
2 hours earlier, Marisol and Taisha had been working in the office when Kim called.
Marisol, you'll never believe it,
Kim said, her voice thick with tears.
We're here at the corporate party, but I'm hiding under the CEO's desk. He's a goddamn sex trafficker.
He's what? Outrage swelled in Marisol's chest. It took a few minutes to get the story out. Kim and her girlfriend Jody were escorting 2 clients to the after party of an awards event where the host had been honored for humanitarian efforts in Mexico. but Kim recognized him as one of several CEOs acquitted despite extensive evidence in a Mexican sex trafficking scandal. Kim had followed the CEO and slipped into his office, where he had locked up the award. After he left, she had tried unsuccessfully to crack the safe. She was sobbing.
I can't breathe. I think I'm having a panic attack. I can't go back to the party and pretend everything's okay. But what was I thinking? I don't know how to open a safe.
But Marisol knew how. An hour later, she and Taisha snuck into the party and Kim let her into the CEO's office. Marisol had smoothed Kim's glossy hair from her face and coached her breathing back to normal. Kim was Korean and in her mid-20s. Marisol had met her when she was a topless waitress in a seedy club. She worked 8 hours, gave the occasional blowjob, and didn't have health insurance. Now she worked one night a week and had a 401k. I'm sorry, Kim said. I know these software guys pay a lot of money. I should have just rolled with it. No, Marisol said, drying the girl's eyes. When you're working and anything goes wrong, you call me, always. Kim nodded and blew her nose. Go back to your date and act like nothing happened, Marisol told Kim. I'll take care of this.
So right away, we can see this is a genre novel, but with a hella Bay sensibility. So people of color at its center, strong women in charge of their lives and their finances. It's got evil, privileged white dudes getting their comeuppance. Are you trying to make a guilty pleasure less guilty?
Absolutely. I believe that so many progressive women, feminists, social justice activists, women of color, we like sort of action, drama, romance, sexy, pulpy stuff. And yet for some reason, those types of stories are so often coupled with a set of politics that are incredibly conservative, misogynist, consumeristic, and it just doesn't have to be that way. So I've created this really kind of fun, sexy, in some ways light story that has this really sort of heavy progressive set of politics. I think of it as wealth redistribution and feminist healthcare wrapped up in a steamy beach read.
And where did the idea for this novel first come from?
Well, I think there were a couple of different pieces. One had to do with the heist genre. You know, historically, it's been so male. And occasionally women would be like the sexy broad they send out to distract the security guard, or, you know, the girlfriend of the head guy. And I love heist. You know, there's something about heist that's so direct action, you know, just immediate redistribution of wealth. And also, in loving the heist genre, I also feel so ambivalent about like big glossy heist movies like Ocean's 11. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the heist procedural, but you know, it's like all these guys, you know, you got 11 people on your team and they're all
and they're
guys.
Not one
you
woman.
Know? Exactly. Even the person who like fits in the little thing whose job it is to be small and flexible is a dude, right? You couldn't even get a woman for that
right.
job, even though we're like whatever biologically superior
in terms
those
of
attributes,
crawling into
in terms of being
things.
Small and flexible, right? And then the other route was I'd worked on other novels, and while I hadn't really made a strategic attempt to get those books published, I had made some attempts, and a lot of the feedback that I was getting was that, you know, stuff that was selling was sexier, you know, and these were books that had characters who, you know, occasionally had sex, but it wasn't like all the time. It wasn't the preoccupation of the books. And so I thought about, okay, like sex is clearly something that there's an appetite for in the readership, but how can I engage the topic of sex in a way that's really political, which immediately led me to thinking about sex work. That sex work sits at the intersection of sex, class, commerce, gender, sexuality, nationality, race, that by having sex worker characters, immediately I would be operating in a highly politicized location with lots of opportunities to explore those issues, as well as the fact that sex workers are so routinely misrepresented and distorted in media, that it would be a really interesting opportunity to have sex worker subjects and sex worker characters that were grounded in a much more three-dimensional characterization than right. usually happens, especially for women of color.
Yeah, that really struck me in reading the book, is that it avoids that the typical portrayal of the sex worker as a powerless victim figure, and instead they're fully empowered workers. They're deserving of basic worker rights and benefits like health insurance and retirement plans. We heard that even just in that small reading that you did earlier. But it seems like you're kind of smuggling in these progressive ideas.
Yeah, recently at my book launch, I did an interview with the fabulous writer Carolina de Robertis, and she has sort of claimed on my behalf that this book is a heist, that the book itself is a cultural heist, that I'm sort of stealing an audience that has historically, within the literary industry, this audience has historically read books that, you know, don't necessarily have these political values, and I'm sort of sneaking these values in there and thinking.
And you agree with that?
I think so. I think that's definitely my intention. And I'm also convinced that the audience that's interested in romance and action and genre is an audience that is really diverse, and parts of that audience are interested in really progressive politics, and other parts of that audience are not at all opposed to progressive politics. So I think that there's a way that sometimes progressives can abandon certain audiences, and so I'm very interested in engaging that audience.
That was KALW's Jen Chien talking with author Aya De Leon. Her new novel, Uptown Thief, is available wherever you buy books. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a sound with a lot of history in the Bay Area.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious.
Hey, if you want to take a flyer?
Makes you so sick at heart.
We're showing a demonstration of what it's like to go through an Israeli checkpoint.
We're trying to get the UC Regents to divest from fossil fuels.
But you can't take part. You can't even passively take part.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? I'll let KALW's Lizak Shalit tell you more.
Hey, if you want to take a flyer?
Well, I'm part of a group called Fossil Free Cal we're trying to get the UC Regents to divest from fossil fuels.
We're here every day from 1 to 3.
We're here because we're promoting an event. It's called Nusantara. It's an Indonesian cultural event.
We're on the campaign team for Annie Tran, and she's running for Senate, and it's for ASUC, which is Associated Students of the University of California.
In the fuzzy, wuzzy golden bear, go Bears!
This is the heartbeat of the Berkeley campus.
This is Sproul Plaza, and that description comes from Nadesan Permal, who came to the University of California as a freshman in the 1960s and never left. We're standing in front of Sather Gate at the north end of the plaza, listening to a student choir and photobombing a father's picture of his son in cap and gown under the arch.
Where this gentleman is standing just behind him, if we could go back to 1968, I would be standing there selling daffodils.
Since then, Paramal has spent 49 uninterrupted years on campus, getting a doctorate, teaching in the poli-sci department, working as an administrator, and serving as president of the Cal Alumni Association. What he most values about this plaza is how it invites students to engage with each other and the world.
During the semester, this plaza during the noon hour is lined with tables in which students try to lure students to join student groups, present political information, a whole variety of different activities.
But it wasn't always this way. We walked to the opposite end of Sproul, where the plaza intersects with Berkeley's Telegraph Avenue.
This border that you see right here as we come to the sidewalk that belongs to both the university and the city used to be the line of demarcation, political candidates had to stand on this side on a box or a platform and address students who were on the other side because no political speech was allowed on the campus.
But that all changed in 1964. A former student got arrested for distributing flyers on the campus side. The rallies that followed brought thousands of students into the plaza and launched Berkeley's fabled free speech movement.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop.
That's the voice of student leader Mario Savio. Within months of this speech, university officials were forced to relax the campus ban on political activity. This ushered in an era of anti-Vietnam War protests, mostly peaceful, but not always. In 1969, then-Governor Ronald Reagan ordered the National Guard to spray demonstrators here. It was the first documented use of tear gas by the U.S. military against its own citizens. Since then, every generation of Cal students has taken the issues of the day to Sproul.
Single file line! Straighten up that line, have IDs out!
Back at Sather Gate, Students for Justice in Palestine are using the arch leading to the plaza for some political theater.
For those who weren't here earlier, we're showing a demonstration of what it's like to go through an Israeli checkpoint, one much like those that dot the West Bank. We're gonna show you what it's like. Single file line!
Have your ID out!
Single file, single file.
Stop! Stop!
Demonstrators from Tikva, a student Zionist group, are holding a counter-demonstration with tarps stained by mock blood. Here's Tikva president Michaela Fried.
For a while, they were telling us that we weren't allowed to be here and that we didn't have the right to free assembly and to demonstrate and to speak from our perspective. And it's kind of funny how the tables turn that way.
An uptick in anti-Semitic incidents on campus have tested tolerance for political expression here. Last March, the UC Regents responded with a statement of principles against intolerance that defends free speech while condemning derogatory speech.
Savio gave his famous speech on those steps. This is a symbol of that.
Fried is pointing to the steps in front of Sproul Hall. At the bottom is a granite disc set flush into the pavement. In the center is a 6-inch hole that marks an invisible column of air.
It says, "This soil and the airspace extending above it shall not be a part of any nation and shall not be subject to any entity's jurisdiction."
That column of air is meant to question the very existence of borders and celebrate the idea of unrestricted space. The plaza as a public space was foremost in the mind of architect Vernon DeMars when it was built in 1961.
His concept was to design two plazas, piazzas, that would be reminiscent of the Piazza San Marco in Venice, which would capture that huge public space. And after all, we have our own version of the Campanile on the campus.
Unlike the Venice version, the Berkeley Campanile houses a 61-bell carillon that chimes out the hour. The original design was quite grandiose, with flagpoles topped by busts of campus personalities and a glockenspiel.
It would have had, on the hour, a door that opened up, and out would have come a golden bear chasing a Stanford Indian with an axe.
That would never pass muster today. But a life-sized golden bear on a giant pillar does stand guard over Zellerbach Hall. It gives the place a rather fantastical air.
Berkeley is thriving. It's alive. It's raucous. I always compare it to that scene in The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy steps out of the black and white and opens the door into the color of Oz.
That's Sproul Plaza, where there's always something vibrant going on. In Berkeley, I'm Lizak Shalit for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Lizak. So many of you knew exactly where we recorded this week. Our winner is Lori Hines. Congratulations! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, check out our newest audiograph mystery sound. Know what that was and where we recorded it? Give us a call, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And a very special thanks to our listeners today. It's the exact day of KALW's 75th birthday. And by a cosmic coincidence, it's also the birthday of our station manager, Matt Martin. A match made in heaven? Yes. Happy birthday, guys. Our team includes Bonnie Chan, Jurgen Klem, Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by the Golden Gate Park Band of San Francisco. The group's origins trace back to 1882, when it was created to support the California National Guard. Find them at their usual performance space, the Spreckles Temple of Music, on Sunday at 1 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.